Why is the actual advent, chronologically, of 1984 led to the such testing of the Liberty Bell as this series of lectures, for example, and it's going on at colleges and universities all over the country, primetime television probes into how prophetic Mr. Orwell turned out to be, whether he intended to be or not. The reason is that Orwell has indeed proved to be prescient. And while Big Brother is not gazing at each of us with a firm proprietary ear everywhere we look, there are troubling intimations that he could be lurking around the corner of the next century. William O. Douglas, 1966. He was dissenting against, in a couple of cases, during which the FBI had used lawyers, defense lawyers, had used an informant to become privy to what defense lawyers were advising their clients. The Supreme Court majority said that's okay. The overwhelming state interest is more important than this slight bending of the Fourth Amendment. And Douglas, having lost the votes, decided he would finally put in one distillation what had been troubling him for a long time. And he said, "We are rapidly entering the age of no privacy." Remember, this is 1966, where everyone is open to surveillance at all times, where there are no secrets from government. The aggressive breaches of privacy by the government increase in geometric proportions. Secret observation booths in government offices, closed television circuits in industry, extending even to restrooms, are common. Offices, conference rooms, hotel rooms, even bedrooms are bugged for the convenience of government. Peepholes in men's rooms are there to catch homosexuals. Personality tests seek to ferret out a man's innermost thoughts on family life, religion, racial attitudes, national origin, politics, atheism, ideology, sex, and the like. Federal agents are often wired so that their conversations are either recorded on their persons or transmitted to tape recorders some blocks away. Polygraph tests of government employees and of employees in industry are rampant, no longer just government employees, folks. The dossiers on all citizens mount in number and increase in size. Now they're being put on computers so that by pressing one button, all the miserable, the sick, the suspect, the unpopular, the offbeat people of the nation can be instantly identified. Police are instructed to pander to the weaknesses and craven motives of friends and acquaintances of suspects in order to induce them to inform. In many cases, keep this in mind, in many cases, the crime has not yet been committed. That's proactive law enforcement. So, 18 years after that warning by Douglas, every one of his proofs that we are entering the age of no privacy has grown more unmistakable, in part because the technology becomes ever more sophisticated and miniaturized, and in part because as time goes on, it's harder for more and more Americans to remember when they had a full-scale expectation of privacy. If you don't remember that, how can you have any sense that you've lost anything? Another factor in the erosion of privacy. In certain of its appearances and functions, the very technology that subverts privacy is very enticing. I mean, think of the wondrous prospects of home tech. The infinitely resourceful two-way cable television. And there you are, comfortably at home, your television set hooked up to cable, to computers, to the telephone. Through a keypad or a computer keyboard, you'll be able to do your banking, shop, order reading material, make airline reservations, answer opinion polls, supply your medical history for remote medical diagnosis, select pay TV movies on an individual basis. And lots more, more every year. How convenient. And how convenient for Big Brother and his staff, who can find out just about everything they want to know about you from tracking your home tech transactions. Your tastes in politics and movies, everybody to whom you make out a check, where you've been and where you plan to go, every bit of your history up to the minute, because of the best single tool Big Brother ever had so far, the computer. David Wise, who has written some marvelous books, scary books, on the CIA, on the FBI, on the whole, if I, by my standards, subversive of the Bill of Rights apparatus of our government, pointed out recently in a piece in the Manchester Guardian, when information is consolidated and made easily and instantly available to those who govern, something new and more ominous is created. The checks and balances, the protections afforded by normal bureaucratic inefficiency, the chance of slipping through the cracks, all of these are gone. We are left with no place to hide. Worse than that, you not only can't slip through the cracks, they have somebody in that machine that isn't you. In New York, a middle-aged man was denied a license to drive a taxi because a computerized credit report showed that when he was 13 years old in Massachusetts, he had been temporarily placed in a mental institution. What the files did not show was that he was an orphan, and the institution was the only home the state authorities could find for him for a period of 6 months. In Massachusetts, the Medicaid benefits of an elderly woman in a nursing home were ordered terminated after a computer match of welfare rolls and bank accounts in the state revealed that she had an account above the Medicaid assets limit. The termination order was improper because the woman's bank account contained a certificate of deposit in trust for a local funeral director to be used for her funeral expenses, an exempt resource under federal regulations. Computer match did not reveal that fact. Gornish Telfin. Yet, as more cities become adapted to computerized everything, including home tech, few of the actual and potential customers of these marvels are asking questions about the safeguarding of their privacy. All I want to know is, how many channels can it watch our apartment for burglars while we're out? You betcha. It can also watch you. About 5 years ago, I guess, I was at a convention in Mobile of the Alabama Library Association. And for once, the first time, the librarians, forget the book displays, they were all clustered around this marvelous new machine, computerized thing, which could tell you exactly who had taken what out from yesterday to 1066 out of your library if it was in existence then. And they were just fascinated. These are the same librarians who had been talking about the need, and there are now finally 11 states that have done this, to pass state statutes so that law enforcement people can't come into a library and say who took out how many books on any number of subjects. The privacy of the individual borrower, for practically every librarian I know, has to be sacrosanct. So I said to them, do you realize, you know, this marvelous toy, you know what it's going to do? It's going to make those laws useless. Because anybody in government can hook into that computer and find out exactly what they want to know without even showing up at the library. But you get conditioned. Orwell did more than merely imagine the future. Quote, with the development of television and the technical advances which made it possible to receive and transmit simultaneously on the same instrument, private life came to an end. Every citizen, or at least every citizen important enough to be worth watching, could be kept for 24 hours a day under the eyes of the police. The possibilities of enforcing not only complete obedience to the will of the state, but complete uniformity on all subjects now existed for the first time, unquote. Ah, obviously he wasn't describing America as we know it. There is, however, a pivotal word in that passage, possibilities. The technology is in the works for making possible, at some time in the American future, unless there is some kind of campaign against this, the constant watching by television in and out of the home of persons of interest to the state. Now, I will now go into the difference between proactive and reactive law enforcement. This is an obsession of mine. I've been writing about it for several years. The FBI asked my son, who this summer was an intern at the Wall Street Journal, if I'd finally gotten tired of it. And the answer was, I don't think so. Reactive law enforcement is exactly what you imagine. Somebody commits a crime, the reaction of the police is to find out who did it. Word gets to the cops that a crime is about to be committed. The reactive law enforcement technique is to stop the crime from being committed, to apprehend the perpetrators before they perpetrate. But proactive law enforcement means that you don't have to wait for the crime. You set up criminal opportunities. For example, you anticipate crimes. I don't want to give Webster all the credit here. It's not fair. J. Edgar Hoover did a lot of proactive law enforcement when his FBI used to infiltrate lawful organizations of heretics in the peace movement, in the civil rights movement, in the expectation that these dissenters would sooner rather than later criminally subvert government institutions. And if business was slow, if the mumses weren't committing any crimes, then the agents were allowed to turn into agents provocateurs and see if they could egg on the commission of crime. This is not really what you'd call an American tradition of law enforcement, or not in the past. Or cops would set up stings to lure larcenous folks, some of whom step up their stealing to take advantage of this attractive new market. The one in Lakewood, Colorado in 1978, two car thieves were so eager to take advantage of a sting operation run unbeknownst to them by the police that they murdered two motorists to get their cars and sell them to the cops. I mean, you can see the enormous potential dividends in proactive law enforcement. Here, for example, were two brand new murders that the cops could immediately solve. Great for the clearance rate. Of course, the killings might not have taken place without the presence of the police-created crime bazaar, but think of all the stolen property that was recovered during the life of this sting, and the police got the two cars back. Abscam was the absolute prototype of proactive law enforcement, and that's why Webster is so happy with it. The fact that, as far as I know, there are only one or two appeals. Let's see, Harrison Williams' appeal is still on, and Kelly's appeal is still on. They're not going to get anywhere. I think it's safe to say that, from his point of view, Webster has been vindicated by the appellate courts. The Supreme Court has refused review on several of the cases. And this is a go-ahead on his part for many more of these techniques, and it's also, of course, an example to be followed and is being followed by police departments throughout the country, state and local police. In Abscam, it's very hard to try to persuade people that there was something wrong with Abscam. I mean, after all, you saw these guys stuffing money into their pockets on television, saying these terribly incriminating things. Let me try for a couple of minutes. Again, remembering that this is supposedly an American constitutional system. Before you use informants, undercover men, I can't say video cameras because they're not covered. Well, neither are undercover men. But let us say, by and large, before you use the whole apparatus of government to go after somebody, there is, at least in theory, or there ought to be, probable cause. That is, the cops ought to have probable cause to believe that either they have committed a crime or that they are about to commit a crime. In every single case of Abscam defendants, without exception, the FBI knew nothing in front about these men that would indicate that they had committed criminal acts or were about to commit criminal acts. Nothing. These guys were brought to the FBI by middlemen, including the Laurence Olivier of undercover informants, Mel Weinberg, who all by himself, if you start checking the transcripts and seeing what was left out of certain tapes and put into other tapes, may well have created enough crimes in which he later implicated people to go away himself for at least 5,000 years. But he's a government agent, and therefore nothing's going to happen to him. In any case, the FBI did no independent investigation of the marks that were brought to them by people like Mel Weinberg. In one case, the case of the congressman from Florida, Kelly, Richard Kelly, you may remember that. It was like the most damning thing that the prosecutors could show on television. Here is Kelly, like in a Three Stooges farce, taking all these greenbacks and stuffing them into his pockets and into his shirt pockets, and he probably would have put it behind his ear if they would have stuck there. If you read the transcript of the trial, the reason the federal district judge in Washington, Bryant, overthrew that indictment, overthrew the jury's verdict, refused to convict Kelly, was that the government had tempted Kelly again and again and again. Kelly had refused again and again and again to take a bribe. There was at one point a Justice Department attorney from a strike force in the basement of this townhouse in Washington they were using to you know, it was like the Roach Motel. They check in, but they never check out. And in the bottom, in the dump, where the dumb waiter starts in this townhouse, there is a line, a telephone line between a Justice Department attorney and an FBI agent upstairs. Kelly has gone to the bathroom or something. The FBI agent says, "I can't do anything with him. He won't. Don't stop. Don't stop," says the voice from below, the voice of the Justice Department. "Go after him." The overturning of that, of the conviction by the jury, by the federal district judge, has now been overturned itself by a reluctant, regretful court of appeals in Washington, which agreed with the judge but said, under the current interpretation of entrapment by the Supreme Court, there's nothing they can do. You want to ask me about that later? I'll tell you. But there was a case, another, Frank Thompson. Frank Thompson was an alcoholic congressman. Transcript in one of the due process hearings, he came into the townhouse, would not agree to anything, would have nothing to do with this whole scam, then goes out. They figure out a way in the meantime, during intermission, to figure how to get him back. Mel Weinberg, working for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, to save his ass, because otherwise he would have been in jail on any number of scams. Mel Weinberg says, "The guy's an alky, right? Well, let's give him some drinks." This is known in the trade, it's a rare thing because the trade doesn't recognize it, as substantive due process. No matter how guilty somebody may be at the end, there are certain things the government cannot do constitutionally to convict him. That's one of them, but the courts so far don't agree. But I'm giving you an idea of what ABSCAM is connected to proactive law enforcement technique and how this, as it spreads, and will certainly eventually, if there is that kind of climate in the country again, take on political content, because they'll be going after not congressmen per se, but people that they find too much trouble for the government to deal with any other way. For example, I there's a friend of mine who used to work for the U.S. Attorney's Office who said to me in the middle of ABSCAM, "If Mother Teresa were in a room with Mel Weinberg for 2 hours and she needed some medicine for the poor, she'd wind up getting 15 years. And again, the business of, yes, they were corrupt because they took the money. Yes, they were corrupt and they took the money. There's no question about that. But I'm more interested in what kind of power this gives the government in future app scams. Paul Cheveny, who's a professor of law at NYU and is an expert on agents provocateurs and all that kind of stuff, I think put the whole danger of the future into one sentence. The power to offer a temptation to crime is the power to decide who shall be tempted. Now, there is the feeling, which I heard a lot during the ABSCAM trials. Oh, no, I mean, one Court of Appeals judge in New York said it. He could have said, "No, we are all of us honest people. We would never be tempted." Well, Justice William Brennan said in 1976, this whole business about somebody being predisposed to commit a crime, therefore when you bag him, doesn't matter how you do it because he was predisposed, so. He said that the accused is predisposed cannot possibly justify the action of government in purposefully creating the crime. No one would suggest that the police could round up and jail all predisposed individuals, maybe one or two in this room. Yet that is precisely what setups like this are intended to accomplish. And it's probably familiar to you, but I cannot resist one of my favorite quotes from Louis Brandeis, dissenting in the first wiretap case, Olmstead versus the United States, 1928. That's where all our troubles started in this field. The first time the Supreme Court dealt with a wiretap, 5-4, they decided a wiretap was not an invasion of privacy under the Fourth Amendment. Brandeis said, the government may not provoke or create a crime and then punish the criminal, its creature. This prosecution should be stopped in order, not in order to release an innocent man, in order to protect the government, to protect it from illegal conduct of its officers, to preserve the purity of the courts. Unfortunately, there is no one on the Supreme Court now who has Justice Brandeis's perspective on this sort of thing. Anyway, last thing about Abscam, what it really proves is if the government convicts you, then it obviously had the right to go after you by any means necessary. That's what they say in Czechoslovakia every day.